Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhousecommunity.com.au.
Much is being written, said and debated about the role of women in church, particularly in ministry. My next guest casts a significant light on it all by looking at the women of the early Christian church, demonstrating powerfully that these women were active at all levels of their religious communities. Professor Lynn Coick is a professor of New Testament at Wheaton College in the US. She's conducted a major study of the place of women in the times of the early church, in families, in society, and in the religious community, shining a particular light on Mary, Mother of Jesus. The professor is in Australia with the Centre for Public Christianity. Lynn, welcome to Open House.
Thank you. It's delightful to be here.
It's great to meet you as well. You have a real passion for history, don't you? What drove that?
I love history, I think, because I like learning about how other people do things. I like the people part of history.
Of all eras of history, why that of the early Christian church?
I think in part because I love reading the New Testament. And the more that I read it, the more I wanted to know, how did people think about this, those that became believers and those that did not? How were they living out their lives?
Why would you say it's important for us to know our history, where we've come from? What do we learn about it?
I think because if we don't understand our past, it's very difficult to move forward. You know, there's the statement we're doomed to repeat our past if we don't really understand it and appreciate it. And I think also that when we appreciate that the New Testament people lived in a particular time and place, and certain things were similar, but a lot of things were different than they are today, once we recognize that, we're better able to understand what the letters and the Gospels were saying.
And it takes us into a living realm. This is no longer just theology or theory, valuable as that is.
Exactly. It's not that the Bible is just a list of do's and don'ts. I think a lot of times people come at it this way. But for me, as I love history and looking at history, these people, I wanted them to become alive, kind of off the page, having jobs and families and going to temple and just all of the stuff that they did during their week.
It's a really valuable study. Can I get you to take us back to the period before the early Christian church? How were women viewed, treated in the world before then?
Well, the Roman world, the Roman Republic and then imperial period, saw a more visible woman. It wasn't like the time of Aristotle when women, elite women, were sequestered in their home. In the Roman period, wives and husbands went together dining. They participated together in the baths. You didn't have kind of a segregation, and women were working in the marketplace. We know they were shop owners. Women, if they had any kind of education, could be learned. They could write. They were artists. They were just about everywhere except in the military, and they weren't emperors. But they could be married to emperors, and as such would have tremendous informal power.
They had a very different position from where they'd been in the years and centuries leading up to that.
Yes, they were. Yeah. I think the Romans just were very comfortable with women matrons, you know, being public, that being public didn't necessarily mean immodesty. But you still had, I mean, it's not like they were men. For sure. There were still what we would call restrictions on women's public voice. Although you would have women sometimes speaking publicly, there was also a concern that they shouldn't speak if their husband was present or something. I mean, you know, there were all kinds of different social protocols, but it was different than in classical Athens when women were quiet.
So if you move on to the early Christian community, specifically in the lifetime of Jesus, in the Gospels, the women around him are mentioned numbers of times, aren't they?
Yes, they are. Jesus, to my mind, treated people as individuals. He didn't focus on, are you a woman? Are you a man? Okay, I'll treat you this way. If a woman was interested in theology, like Martha, resurrection, then he spoke to her about that. If the Samaritan woman wanted to know more about religious practices, where do I worship? Jesus talked to her about that. In fact, he made a remarkably deep theological statement to her that God should be worshipped in spirit and truth. That was, you know, a very deep conversation that they would have entered into, and he did it with a woman whose name we don't even know.
Is it notable to observe that women were a significant part of the biblical narrative, that they were there in that narrative?
I think it is important because we tend to imagine Jesus with his 12 men, the 12 apostles, as though, you know, it was just kind of a men's club. That might be what the painters in the Renaissance pictured, but it's not actually what's on the biblical pages.
How would you define Jesus' attitude towards these women?
I think first and foremost, he saw them as human. And he didn't see them through the lens of they're a woman, first and foremost. He saw them as a disciple or as a potential follower.
Were they attracted to him because of his attitude to them or by his message or both?
I think probably both. And I say that because I think he seemed to be someone who welcomed all manner of people, even little children. You know, so he seemed to be a very approachable person. But also, I think there are women at this time who are asking theological questions. What about resurrection? Is it now that God is going to do something big in Israel? Is the Messiah coming? These are questions men and women were asking.
As I said, you've taken a particular interest in the life of Mary. What are the aspects of her life that you believe we would do well to understand and learn from?
The Protestant Church, which I'm a part of, United Methodist in the United States, has sometimes not spent as much time, I think, honoring Mary as the mother of Jesus. But I would say that overall, I think the Church has failed to appreciate that Mary is an example of discipleship for a man and a woman. She's a faithful disciple, sometimes not fully understanding things, but steadfast in walking after Jesus.
It might be a curious thing to say because she was also his mother.
That's right. Yeah. And as Jesus began his ministry, well, actually, even when he was maybe 12 or 13 even, he began to show signs of understanding a ministry that he would have. And then certainly once he started his ministry, he refocused their relationship and treated her as a disciple. So John's gospel has Jesus referring to his mother as woman, not in any derogatory way, but to elevate her, if you will, to say, you know, you're my mother, which is always a very precious relationship, but I also want more. I want you to hear my message and to follow after it.
Would you think it was sometimes confusing for her as she was dealing with these various aspects of her role and their relationship?
I think it had to be. I think it also probably was painful to see her son and his message not being accepted. I think it probably was frightening at times because she had to have known that Jesus was making enemies of the religious leaders and the Romans. And so I think she probably had quite a lot of uneasy nights in wondering how all this was going to end. And of course, she was there at the end at the cross. I can't imagine all the emotions that were going through her.
What can we learn about discipleship, being a follower of Jesus, someone who learns from Jesus, from Mary specifically?
I think from Mary what we learn is that we might think we know where God is going, but you might throw in some turns. At the beginning, when she finds that she's pregnant and she's so excited, she bursts into song. It's clear she knows the scriptures. She's well educated in Judaism, but she's imagining a type of kingdom that God will bring in that is smaller than what God intends to do. And so as Jesus goes about his ministry and he does things that she didn't anticipate, she represents for us, I think, the disciple who's trying to figure things out, trying to be faithful, trying to be steadfast. And she is steadfast. But I think she spends a lot of time being confused.
On Open House, we're with Professor Lynn Coeck, Professor of New Testament at Wheaton College in the US. Lynn, by the time the early Christian church develops, we have the Apostle Paul, who's often portrayed as anti-women. What does the biblical narrative reveal about his attitude to them?
I think it's a shame that Paul is portrayed or labeled that way. I can understand it because I think sometimes his words have been used as a bit of a bludgeon against women, but I don't think that's what Paul intended. He works with women as his co-workers. He addresses Andronicus and Junia, for example, probably a husband and wife team. He calls them apostles, and he praises them. They went to prison for their faith. He talks about Phoebe, who's a deacon and who was his benefactor. He works alongside Yodia and Syntyche. That's mentioned in Philippians 4. These women are co-workers. They're very important for the church in Philippi, and he addresses them specifically about an aspect of ministry, that they seem to be on different pages. He wants them on the same page. And so when I look at that, I think, well, Paul is working closely. He lived with Priscilla and Aquila there in Corinth. Acts 18 tells us that. And Priscilla, with Aquila, taught another disciple, Apollos, and that man spent a lot of time working with Paul. And so Paul was obviously fine with women having very important leadership roles as members of his team in his various churches.
You mentioned Junia and Andronicus. They're an interesting study about the whole meaning of the word apostle and what an apostle is.
That's right. And it means messenger. And so you have the question then, what meaning is behind this, that Paul uses it to call them apostles? And I'm fine if he means that it's messenger. It's clear that these are very important and influential people in the church, and that they are paying with their lives, basically. They're imprisoned for the faith. But if you say that Junia is not really an apostle, well, then be consistent. And when the term appears elsewhere in relation to men, you have to look at each context. Let's just not assume that because she's a woman, she can't be an apostle. The early church, and I mean like in the early centuries, the church fathers, saw Junia, that it was amazing that here she should be revered because she's called an apostle.
You mentioned the various roles women took and were assuming. One of those was benefactor of many of the apostles and indeed Jesus.
That's right. In Luke 8, we find that Mary Magdalene, Joanna, the wife of Cusa, who is Herod's steward, and Susanna, those three gave of their own funds. And that's something to remember, that women could inherit and they could control their own funds. And maybe in the Jewish world, they didn't directly inherit, but the parents could give gifts that functioned in relatively the same way. And so women had personal financial autonomy, even when they married. And these women chose to give that towards Jesus' ministry.
In the midst of all this, can I take you to one particular passage, which is the source of so much debate, let's say. 1 Timothy 2, from the Apostle Paul. A woman should learn in quietness and full submission. I do not permit a woman to teach or to assume authority over a man. She must be quiet. For Adam was formed first, then Eve. What should women, and for that matter men, take out of that passage?
We have to make sense of it in light of verse 15 as well. That's the end of the argument. But she will be saved through childbearing if they continue in faith and love and holiness. And I tease my classes that I say, I know that I'm going to heaven because I've had two children. And so I'm good, you know. And they all laugh because they realize that's absurd. It's an absurd way to understand what Paul is saying. But he does use the word, she will be saved. That verb is how he describes salvation elsewhere. And of course, we know Paul doesn't mean that a woman having a baby, after she has a baby, she's good to go to heaven, right? So he's not saying that. So whatever he's talking about here has to, we have to make sense of it in light of verse 15 as well. We also should note at the very beginning that the let a woman learn is actually in command form. Paul is saying you have to teach women. And then when you get to the permit, it's not in the command form, even though in English it sounds like a command. He's saying, I'm not permitting a woman to teach or to have authority over men. The other thing you need to consider is that that word authority is a rare word. It's not used anywhere else in the New Testament, even though the English translation authority is used everywhere. And there's a common word in Greek that is usually translated as authority. But here, this term, it's just extremely rare Greek word. And when it's used elsewhere, generally has a very negative meaning to it. So what it seems we have here is women teaching or in some way being oppressive or negatively authoritative towards men.
Overbearing?
Overbearing would be another way to say it. I think so, yes. To my mind, these various points and some others add up to a scenario where you have women who don't know, who are nevertheless teaching, and what they're teaching perhaps in some way is a variation on the creation theme, because as you mentioned, he talks about Eve being deceived. And we know that a little bit later in church history, you get this very virulent heresy called Gnosticism that in part kind of rereads Genesis to say that the creator God, Jehovah, is really like a false god, and that Eve, in eating from the tree of knowledge, gnosis, reveals this false creator God. Well, if even a smattering of that sort of thing is going on, and I think there are other places in Timothy where we get a hint that that might be what they're facing there in Ephesus, I would, like Paul, say, time out. Women can't be teaching these things because they're not the correct things. They need to learn.
So he's talking to a group of women specifically rather than women generically.
I think so, yes. Yeah. But it would apply in any context where you would have, and frankly, he says things like this to men as well, who, if they're teaching something wrong, he would say, cease and desist until you learn what the gospel really says.
While the debate in the Christian community about the role of women has ranged over a wide variety of viewpoints, as you reflect on your studies, how should women be relating to the church, especially when it comes to leadership, which is often a point of contention, and how should the church be relating to women?
I wish that we didn't have to phrase things in terms of men and women, because I think once we start with that, we're already off on the wrong foot, although I appreciate your question. But I think as I look at the earliest disciples around Jesus, there just wasn't pink disciples and blue disciples, if I can use that, in Paul's communities. While obviously there were social conventions that men followed and different ones that women followed, when they were all together in Christ, they didn't have the kinds of restrictions in terms of leadership that might have been going on in the broader community.
Professor Lynn Koch, I've very much enjoyed our conversation. Thanks so much for joining us on Open House.
Thank you very much.
Lynn has authored a book on her studies, Women in the World of the Earliest Christians, Illuminating Ancient Ways of Life. We'll put the details up on our Open House community Facebook page.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. To hear more from Open House, visit openhousecommunity.com.au.